You wrote a handwritten letter to Brent Mason. How'd you get his address?
When I heard that Telecaster, I was like, what in God's name? That's the greatest thing I've ever heard. So now we're going to stir up the comments section.
Stir up the pot a little bit
here,
Andy.
We're going to make everybody mad.
Why is it still worth studying Van Halen? Andy Wood on the podcast. How are you, sir?
Dude, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on, man. Play us a lick. Play us in with something. Just give us a little taste of I don't know. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Very ethereal. Very ethereal.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you were 17, Andy, you wrote a handwritten letter to Brent Mason. And you mailed it to him.
It was around that range, 16, 17, somewhere in that range.
How'd you get his address?
I didn't mail it to Brent. I actually mailed it to, I believe it was just a vanilla address to Mercury Records. I think Hotwired was released on Mercury, I think, back in the day.
Yeah.
And my mother, actually, she was like, well, we'll send it here. Surely he'll get it, you know. So it just went to... out, it's like putting the letter into the bottle and throwing it out into the water.
Yeah, right, right.
And so not long after that, I got the return letter that was, I could tell it was by him because, I mean, even 16, 17-year-old kid could tell it was him because there was like a whiteout mark on the date where he had a typo. You know, back then, this is pre-cell phone.
Wait, but couldn't that have been a secretary who just whited it out?
I mean, and, if you know Brent, the vernacular and the whole thing, like, I didn't know him at the time, but becoming a friend with him now, it's like, yeah, this obviously checks out. This is Brent, you know.
Wait, and what did you say to him?
Man, it was, hey, man, you're really cool. You know, it was like the vanilla kind of, you're great. I like you. You're awesome. You know,
and did he write anything back? Any wisdom, or what did he write back?
It was funny because it really wasn't like a wisdom thing. It wasn't really a long letter. And I remember one of the things I do remember because he said, most people don't realize this. I like to sing. And I remember that. I don't know why I remember that, but I remember that being out of all the things he put in there. He's like, most people don't realize this. I like to sing. And so obviously getting older and going to see him at Third and Lindsley and stuff like that, you know, he sings a lot on those gigs.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah, I mean, he's got a great voice, and I mean, you know, it was just, I don't know why that detail sticks out to me.
What was the record? It was a Mark O'Connor record.
Yeah.
That really was influential.
Yeah,
you.
It was the Pick It Apart thing. It was the, you know, the one.
What's
that
the
was
lick?
Like,
why did you love that?
You know, it was the solo. Can't remember it all. I can't remember it all. What was that? I forgot it. But there's a video somewhere of me playing it. But that I actually bought that record because of Sam Bush and Jerry Douglas and Bela Fleck and that whole crowd of bluegrass guys. I mean, I didn't play electric guitar at the time that I heard that. And I bought it because that record had a song called Granny White Special on it. And it was like Sam and Jerry and, you know, doing the Omega Mutant level bluegrass.
Yeah, right, right.
That's what I was into.
Yeah.
Specifically that squad of guys. You know, a lot of bluegrass fans that are going to watch this will know it as like the Strength in Numbers guys, right?
What do you mean? Like the guys who play with a lot of other guys?
No. It was actually, it was like a tour, and so it was like called Strength in Numbers.
Oh, okay.
And all of those guys were on Mark O'Connor's Nashville Cats record. And, you know, again, the lineup was Fleck on banjo, you know, like most of the time be like Roy Husky Jr. on bass, Jerry Douglas on dobro, Fleck. Or sorry, you know, probably be Sam Bush or Sam on mandolin, and you know Tony would play guitar. But on the Nashville Cats record, I think Granny White Special, somebody will fact check me. I think it's Russ Barenberg on that tune, anyways, regardless, details aside, track four was Pick It Apart. And of course, it's like that super hot fiddle thing. And Paul Franklin and Matt Rollins was playing piano. When I heard that Telecaster, I was like, what in God's name? Is that the greatest thing I've ever heard? Like, that's not even real. It's so great, it's not real. And that's what made me want to play electric guitar. And so from there, it was like, that was like the gateway into Jimmy Page and everything. Like, everything that every guitar player starts on. Because I think it's fair to say that most electric guitar players don't start with Brent. They start with Angus Young,
yeah,
or Clapton, or Van Halen. You know what? Who was yours? What was your first guitar guy?
Joe Perry.
So it's like, yeah, it's like Walk This Way or whatever. And you're like, I got to figure out how to do that.
Yeah.
For me, it was really Brent. It was that, and I was like, God, man, you know.
Yeah.
So from there, that's how I got to Jeff Beck and Chick Corea. And
do you see a big country influence in Jimmy Page's playing?
Actually, yeah, I do. I don't like the word country so much as Americana.
Do you see an American? Because to me, when you learn like the solo in Black Dog, for example, that to me could be a country solo or an Americana,
especially in today's
solo. Yes,
in the past 20 years of what Nashville is. Yeah, for sure. And man, you don't have to stretch too far to get old Jimmy Page on some acoustic. Some Battle of Evermore with JPJ playing some mandolin, like that could be on a Punch Brothers or a Nickel Creek record,
yeah,
or you know, Daryl Scott record. I mean, those kind of things. I feel like Zeppelin, of course, was a hard rock band, but boy, they just really had such a spectrum and such a throw of it was just Zeppelin's music, and you hear, you know, what was it, Barnyard Stomp and all that stuff. It's like, man, that's Americana.
I feel like I stopped finding my favorite guitar players. Like, my favorite guitar players today are the same ones I loved.
Same ones, yeah.
When I was... That makes sense. Probably when I was 17, when you were going on a whole new journey of guitar players, that's when my favorite guitar players stopped. Like, I've discovered other guitar players that I like and I love, but not my favorites.
I mean, we've all got our Mount Rushmore.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, this is a fun game. If you take Mount Rushmore and you go, okay, here's a couple of names that don't count because they're everybody's Mount Rushmore. You can't say Van Halen.
Yeah.
Can't say Clapton. Can't say Jeff Beck. Who are they? So, like, outside of those, my Mount Rushmore on any given day will always have, like, it'll always be Brent. It'll always be Tony Rice.
Yeah.
And then the next three, or there'd be two, but the three could interject, would be Dan Huff, Eric Johnson, and Steve Morse. Those are the three that, like, really, because and you know, the ironic thing about all three of those guys, they're like, you know, super aggressive kind of players with a lot of sass and a lot of attitude, a lot of distortion, a lot of chops, but they all three can stretch into a lot of different lanes. They're not really one dimensional. I mean, you could take that's actually a jam I would love to see, would be EJ, Steve Morse, and Huff just play a tune together, because they all have such a high level of technical proficiency. They're all three tone guys. Like, they all three have a really great sound, you know, because a lot of times chops guys, the tone's not as great as, like, you compare it to, like, freaking Huff, you know. It's like, Huff sounds great on everything.
Yeah.
You know, some of my favorite stuff was The Summer's Coming solo, Clint Black. And then also, you know, he's the turn around and hear like something like Heart as a Lonely Hunter, the Reba McEntire with the I always say it's one of the best neck pickup strats.
But I feel like
ever, man.
I almost hear some of his influence on like I'm a Believer and some of the Giants.
Oh, for sure.
In your playing. But do you
for sure? Because I mean I learned all that stuff too. There's covering what's the opening track? Stay. I'm gonna mess it up, but it's got the it's got that thing. What is it? How's it go? Isn't that it?
Yes.
It's got that thing in it or whatever.
Yeah,
I mean, like, I learned all that stuff.
Wait, so how did you... So you're learning this Brent Mason solo at 17.
Oh, I said, no, I didn't learn it at 17. I was attempting it.
You were attempting it.
I'm not learning it.
Wait,
at
so
all.
So how did you creep into that? Are you laughing because you just didn't have the ability to learn it back then?
I'm just laughing because it's so dumb. It was so far above my pay grade. It's still so far
so
above my pay
grade. So how did you get into that? Or like, where did you start to develop
just like
those
chops
then?
At that time in life, I'd been playing mandolin for a good 12 years or 13 years. So I mean, I was playing like fast bluegrass music.
Yeah.
The thing that I specifically remember having on it that was funny was I had the opening line in the wrong fingering. Knowing Brent now and like learning it in depth as an adult, you know, it's, which is a Brent fingering.
Right.
I had it like that.
What's
so I had
the
it,
fingering?
Like, wrong.
Like what is
Now obviously Brent's thumbnail and fingers. Right. So just don't assume the right hand, but and the
versus
hardest
what?
Part,
how are you?
I had it something like that.
So he was playing on higher strings, basically?
It was like taking it across three string set
yeah.
instead of a two string set. The other thing that was really hard about that solo that opened up a lot of doors and actually, you know, such a fundamental like centerpiece to my playing now was having to learn the finger style licks with a flat pick and a middle finger. And I remember the one that really killed me, I was trying to play. That line, and I could play it at a jog. You know, I could play it there. But I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it at like the tempo of the record. No. It's like crazy.
Yeah.
So like
yeah.
learning it was like down, up, down, middle. That's what opened the door for me. So down, up, down. In the right hand.
So what was the moment when you got it? Like, how would you figure this stuff out? Like, were you slowing it down somehow, or were you just
One of those red Tascam things that would, like, hold the CD in place, but you had to, like, ignore all of the jittering.
Yeah.
So that was a big thing that I used a lot. And then I remember having the Hotwired DVD. Not Hotwired, Hot Licks.
The Arlen Roth Hot Licks.
We all have.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we all got it. Brad Mason one. Yeah.
We've all got it. And I remember watching him on that one. And there was another fingering thing that I had wrong. It was a. That's how I had it, playing it like a bluegrass kid.
Right.
Because these are bluegrass lines. You know, but like Brent was playing it.
Right.
You know, that thing. So it was like.
Which sounds so much more like it.
You know, learning it the right way.
The Hotwired, yeah, yeah.
Or whatever it goes to, right? But I mean, dude, I was living and breathing that stuff. And in the same day, I'd be working on Cliffs of Dover or Too Many Notes or Stress Fest or any of those Steve Morse tunes. And I'd also be working on the Van Halen stuff, the, you know, like whatever. I just felt like somebody had just handed me like the ultimate video game where it was like, you can go anywhere and do anything.
Yeah.
Go get them.
I've heard you say that. The worst way or a mistake when you're trying to practice something fast is to practice it slow, that you have to practice it fast. Is that a misunderstanding that a lot of guitar players have? Yeah.
This is one of my favorite things to stir up. So now we're going to stir up the
comments
section.
Stir up the pot a little bit
here,
Andy.
We're going to make everybody mad.
Because maybe I've been doing this wrong, because I always practice stuff slow. Oh. That's what I was always taught.
So
tell me otherwise,
okay,
Andy.
Okay, this is funny, right? Because I know everybody's going to be arguing in the comments. I think that you don't practice slow. You have to practice at the speed that it's going to be played at. I'm going to tell you why after I tell you this. You've got to learn it first. Most people equate learning and practicing to the same thing. Those are not the same steps for me personally. Learning it and having the knowledge of what is the correct roadmap on the fretboard changes or technique or whatever, learning it is the acclimation of what it's like, the acquiring of what it is. Most people don't spend enough time on that. They're ready to start practicing it, but they'll sit there with a metronome and play. So let's take a lick that's real kind of industry standard bluegrass lick, right?
Yeah.
Most people will probably practice that. Now watch my hand. Now if I play that fast, it's a completely different thing.
Yeah.
So even though I'm starting with a downstroke and following with an upstroke and repeating as necessary, that's not the same feeling in my hand. So if I practice it slow, you're going to get to a certain BPM and be like, I can't do it any faster. Well, that's because you're practicing the wrong thing. You're not practicing it where it needs to be. It needs to be like a buffing wheel that's just flying. And you need to be able to polish it at tempo, because that mechanic is different, right? Like, that's a completely
totally different thing.
Totally different mechanic, yeah. Than look at the swing. It's like I'm like using all of this motion and like time, literally time, to keep time of the groove. Well, at tempo, when that's like you've got it feels different. So most people are ready to start practicing something before they've actually learned it. And as they play, they're hitting wrong notes. So they're trying to keep playing it slow. You see how this feeds itself?
Yeah.
Learn the mother
effort. Learn slow.
Learn it.
Yeah.
And then play it where it needs to be. If the tempo to one of those tunes is cooking like that, back it down, but don't back it down by much. You back it down maybe 10. If anything's north of a buck 85, you need to be practicing
even on those,
it.
Like, the one that always kills me is the Sugarfoot Rag on the Brent Mason album.
Yeah,
is so fast. I could never even play it that fast. Like,
you know, it's like that. That's a, you know, to play, you know, whatever the line is.
Yeah.
Like, you've got to be able to drive at that tempo, because by that, let me clarify that. To drive at tempo means to be clear-minded, right? You're not stressing about it. Because I want to be able to play my own leads at that tempo. The big tidal wave hit me earlier last year when I was really starting to get on stage with my Guitar Heroes. And I was like, okay, you're now doing, you're trading solos with these guys. These are the dudes you grew up listening to, and you're trading solos with them. You can't just play their solos back to them.
Yeah. Why not? Because they don't want to hear that. They want to hear something
else. Well, they're going to play their solos.
Right. So it's lame. It's lame if you're gonna do it.
So when when you're in these opportunities, it's a real eye opener to go, yeah, well, now why am I here and what am I going to play? So if I'm trading solos with Brent on Blowing Smoke or Hotwired or whatever, I want to be able to play creatively and sound like me, right? So if I'm stressing about I can't get the notes to be clean, my mind's already in the wrong spot, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So like that equation and reasoning of technique and speed comes from the point of view of very much a bluegrass kid. It's the same mentality, right? Like if I'm going to play, Salt Creek or Big Mon or one of these old bluegrass tunes on mandolin, I don't want to be hanging on for dear life with my legs flapping in the wind. I want to be like driving the thing at tempo, you know? So practicing needs to happen close to tempo, because you want that to be a familiar thing that happens. I'll give you one more example. You ever been on a gig and there's one or two licks coming in the gig? Let's say the gig's 85 minutes long.
Yeah. But
there's two moments in the gig where you're like, God dang it. Yeah. And you're watching it all night and you're just stressing out about it. And then when it finally gets there, you might nail it, you might blow it, but you just kind of watch it go by.
Yes. Yeah.
You've been there,
but
right?
You know what? Sometimes those licks for me aren't even technical stuff.
Oh, it doesn't have to be, right?
Sometimes it's like very exposed stuff that you just have to nail and
so
play
perfectly.
So that's
the same mentality.
Yeah.
The way you would practice that is to practice that vibe. And that gets into, what does it mean to practice? And for me, it means playing these tunes standing up. Like my records have a lot of hard stuff to play, or I think it's hard. It's like not easy for me. I got to stand up and do it and look at the crowd and entertain and not look like, and be able to do I got to be comfortable. You know, I've got to be able to address my band members and, you know, like do the thing. So it's like practice means more than taking 25 swings at it. And then when I get the one that I nailed, putting that on Instagram. The irony is most of the things, I'd say 95% of anything that I post online is within the first three takes. It's just because like I want to hurry up. I want to get to the next thing. And, you know, it's like my life is not creating you know, perfect 30-second videos.
Yeah.
So when anybody sees anything, you know, it's like, I've got to where I use a lot of cell phone footage because I want people to hear how hard I'm hitting, because I actually play a lot harder than people realize. You know, it's like, you know, if I'm playing...
really snapping it.
That's where the tone is. You know, if I put the dirt on it... You know, it's like the tone is there. I actually use less gain. This is like everything control is wide open. You know, if I split the coil. That's still the same gain as. You know, it's all at that same level. This being the distortion pedal.
The thing that always surprises me about your playing, like you were just playing Free Range Chicken a second ago.
Yeah.
The thing that always surprises me is that you actually don't hybrid pick that much because you're mostly alternate picking.
Right.
But to me, that's weird. Wouldn't you have wanted to have developed alternate picking being such a Brent Mason fan?
I do when I'm chicken picking.
Yeah.
When I'm doing the clean amp back pickup telly thing, it's this.
It is that.
It is that. It has to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah. It's like, let's just use an audio example here. So if I got as telly as a humbucker can be, let's play versus. I mean, that's where the tone is.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that's so much of that attitude that I love in Brent's playing, you know, and you can't get that with a pick.
But do you like in like Free Range Chicken, for example, off your solo record, Charisma?
Yeah. Well, shameless plug.
Shameless
guys.
Plug for Charisma, the solo record from Andy Wood. Why, to me, I would almost think that song, in the vein of it, you were very okay just alternate picking the whole thing versus hybrid picking it.
Yeah, because the tune wasn't written as a chicken picking tune at all.
Really?
It was written as a Dixie Dregs thing.
Yeah.
Kind of a Steve Morse Dregs-ism. Right. And on the demo, I had written that, you know, the name is, you know, it's like, I was like, oh, well, we got to have some kind of moment where it goes to telly chicken Something, picking yeah. things, right? So on the demo, I was playing it, and I see, maybe it was my buddy Travis Toy, it was one of the bros, had said, man, wouldn't it be cool to get Brent on that? And I was like, oh, yeah, but, you know, he's too busy and famous, whatever, you know. Travis like, man, you should just text him. Maybe he'll do it. And sure enough, I sent the text. I was like, hey, man, I don't know. He's like, man, I'm honored. And I was just floored. And then when he turned in the solo, the first solo, he turned in one on Friday, I remember this. And it was a heater, like full-on Brent heater. By Saturday afternoon, he had texted me. He goes, hey, man, don't use that one. I want to send you a good one. I was like,
what?
Okay. So then he sent the one on like
and
Monday.
And was it better?
And it was the one that's on the record.
Was it better, though? Did you listen to it?
It's not better. It's different.
It's just different. Yeah, yeah.
But it had a lot of the things that are, to me, very quintessential. It had the, what was that? Oh.
When he hangs on like the flat seven right there, that's so Brent.
That lick right there, that one is like so Brent that yeah. I love the like that whole descending line. I just sent it to Travis and I was like, dude, are you ready? And so he kicks it open. He goes, man, he goes, the good news is if everybody, every guitar player hates you and hates your record, they're still going to get it because that one Brent solo.
Because that one lick, everyone's
so
going to learn. Yeah. How important was it when you were learning a lot of these licks, or maybe now, like sometimes I'll try and learn these solos that are really intricate. Sometimes you almost can't even hear what the exact notes are or what the exact licks is.
Sure.
Does that drive you crazy? Because sometimes that makes me so frustrated. Do you focus on learning every single exact note, or if you capture the essence of it, is that enough for you?
I think for me, the right answer and the honest answer is somewhere where it's both of those things.
Yeah.
Right. So like I sat down, obviously, you know, I've got to play Free Range Chicken and I'm not got Brent with me. So I have to learn the Brent solo, right? So out of like the respect and love that I have for Brent, learning free range chicken, it's like I want to learn that as accurately as possible. I mean, it's my childhood, you know, kind of hero or whatever. And also it's like I think people in the audience want to hear that or moments of that. Now, however, I think there's something very valuable to be said about not using tablatures and a YouTube thing where someone's spoon feeding you the music, you know, how to play
it. Sometimes those True Fire courses I think are so helpful.
Here's the reason.
You have True Fire courses.
Hold on. Okay, no, in all seriousness,
tell me how you feel.
It's because I think the process of learning is more important than being able to play something. I'm going to elaborate. If you can, if someone is spoon-fed you fret by fret, you're playing stuff that you don't understand how it functions. You're just being a parrot that's really good at mimicking.
Yeah.
Now, if you go to Broadway and you've learned half a dozen Brent solos perfectly, and you get on stage and they call a song that's not one of those half a dozen, you're toast.
Yeah.
You're cooked.
Yeah.
So a great example of learning something and learning it the wrong way is Nuno Bettencourt. Like him learning Van Halen and not knowing what he was doing gave us Nuno Bettencourt.
Yeah.
So it's like the process is more valuable than the outcome. Now, with that said, there's nothing wrong. And I encourage folks after they've worked on something or maybe while they're working on it to understand and digest the thing, maybe note for note, or like, no, he's using, you know, if anybody ever says, you know, oh, Andy played that pick it apart just like Brent. I never did because I don't use a thumb pick and I don't have the finger. So it's even as close as I can get it. And it sounds like it. It's like, it's still not exactly it. And that's a fool's errand because Vince Gill's not retiring tomorrow. John Petrucci's not going to not tour next year.
Yeah.
So why obsess to the point of losing your own identity to say that you can play one of the solos note for note? Well, that's cool. You put your flag in the mountain. Hey, I've been there.
Right.
But it's still, and I don't want to sound preachy. I don't. It's still just, you're just putting on the cape and running around the bedroom and pretending you're Superman.
Yeah.
You're still wearing your dad's shoes.
I feel like you've transcribed so many solos.
Sure, and I have.
Yeah.
And I have done that. But even so, there was an end goal with them. Like, Andy Campbell's a drummer that I use all the time, and he and I have been in bands since we were 20 years old, 21 years old. We covered Dream Theater songs. Like, we learned the tunes with the intent of playing them live. You know, we played Cliffs of Dover in bars. You know, it's like, and even now, last year, my trio with Ben and Andy, we were playing Too Many Notes live. We played Zap at shows. So it's like, when I was setting out to learn tunes, it was something bigger than to play it in my bedroom and record it and put it on YouTube or whatever. It was like there was a musical purpose behind it. And when I'd get to the solo sections, it was like, okay, time to improvise and be Andy. You know what I mean? It's like, that's what makes a good cover good is it doesn't sound like Stevie Ray's Little Wing. What makes it great is it's not Hendrix's Little Wing.
What was the musicality takeaway in Cliffs of Dover?
Oh,
like
I
beyond
mean,
playing it note for note, was there anything that you learned that you put into your playing?
Everything. I mean, everything about that thing is just, it's so fundamental to the way that I play guitar. The spread triads that I use all the time, you know, it's like those kind of things that are, you know. You know, all that kind of stuff.
And that was you specifically grabbed those in Cliffs of Dover. Yeah, like yeah. That's so right what you picked off.
It's all that stuff, right?
Yeah, oh, right, so, right. You know,
it's a little darker tone, make it a little more accurate.
Right. Yeah.
You know, all of that kind of stuff that. Sorry. All of those kind of lines that I play a lot, that all was came from studying Cliffs and multiple versions. Every version I could find, I was trying to steal more from it. And Man, even that opening intro is just so nice with the. Was it?
Oh, from the live version.
Yeah. What's the lick that's so pretty? It's got the. Or something like that. I think maybe down in there. It's something like that. But learning all that stuff was so valuable because that's something I use when I write. Like, I still use that stuff for being a session player or whatever.
So where's the line in your head between, like you were saying, like putting on the cape and pretending to be Superman versus like getting the value from learning these things note for note?
The line is when you are never taking something you've learned and taking it beyond where you learned it. If you're only playing the EJ licks within the EJ songs, you're still just in your bedroom wearing your dad's shoes.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
But like the moment you go to a jam and you play in Crosstown Traffic or something and you whip out one of those descending fives, now you're taking something from where you found it and putting it in a new place. And that's been my whole thing, is like combining all the things that I like. I never set out to be like this, like, muso fuso kind of player that does this, some bluegrass, some country, some rock, some fusion. Like, it was just, I went through life and anything I liked, I learned. And the outcome of that is like the way I sound and the records that I make and the tunes that I write. And if you hear a song like Smoke Wagon, you're going to hear elements of the Helicasters and Brent Mason and John Jorgensen, Vince Gill and the Telly thing. You're going to hear that. But also there's like weird changes that are like very Dregsy. Like that, the head of that tune starts off very kind of Brent. Like that's right. Like combining Brent isms, like, but with like harmony. The tune's in D. Like, why would you get E flat, B flat? And if you take that and expand it out, and you go, there's the EJ influence,
right.
In a tune like Smoke Wagon. So like to me, it's like the end result is like I've taken my favorite pieces and made my own
thing of it.
Thing, yeah. And like people can comment all day long, be like, oh man, yeah, I could tell you like Steve Morse. I'm like, sure. I could tell you like Brent, yeah, obvious. I could tell you like EJ, yeah. If it's like the end of the thing, it's like it's still its own mishmash.
Yeah.
And I think that's the line, is like, are you only playing Cliffs of Dover licks within Cliffs of Dover? That's the line.
No, that makes sense. What was the process? You're playing through the Gearbox right now from Wampler, signature overdrive. What was the process designing a pedal? Because there's so many things you could do with it.
Right.
And I also think one of the coolest things on it is the gate.
Yeah, man.
Is there another pedal that you've ever seen that has a gate on it?
Yeah, I think guys do gates. I think you see it more commonly in the metal world. Like my good friend Misha that plays in the band Periphery, I think one of his Horizon pedals might have a gate on it. Yeah. I think one of the Van Halen pedals, like the overdrive, I might be wrong on this, but I think it might have a gate as well. But to me, it came from a very working man's ethos, where it's like, man, I play some old theaters from time to time, or you play in town, you plug into Third and Lindsley stage, it's gonna buzz.
Yeah.
And so for me, it was like, we might even be able to test it right here if I roll the gate out completely. So there's a little bit there. Now let's step on the high gain side. This is both sides. There's Nashville.
Yeah.
That's the ground floor of Nashville. So
I'm just going to roll the gate in until it grabs.
So I'm not using it to be Dimebag Darrell, but I'm just using it to grab that noise floor. And then the gain I'm using is pretty nuclear right now. Yeah. Got a lot of gain. You're not going to do that on a Wayland.
I struggle with
Jennings
that too.
Gig.
And then I think about putting like a noise gate or something on it, but the noise gates that I've used,
they clamp.
Yeah, they
clamp because that's what they're designed to do, So this was just from that aspect, and the pedal itself was just kind of designed from the aspect of the working guitar player, you know, and I with the guitar and the compressor and the overdrive box, anything that you see that's got my name on it, we didn't design it or start with like, hey, let's do signature stuff. It was always me going, I want to solve some problems. I don't care if you make it for the rest of the world or not. Will you make it for me? And ironically, some of this gear has solved problems for other people that ran into the same things.
Yeah.
You know.
And the signature guitar too. I mean, you've made a lot of videos talking about it, but it's got so many cool things.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big
about
thing
it.
Right there.
The heel joint. Yeah, yeah.
Right. And it's, you know, having the neck pickup close enough on a 24 fretter to where it's not back. These are common sense things to me. Ironically, it's just solved a lot of problems for other players too that were running into those same barriers, you know.
Right.
So,
okay, I want to name a handful of guitar players, and I would love for you to say maybe one or two characteristics that other people should take away from their playing.
Ooh, this is a fun game.
Okay. And it's not just gonna be guitar players.
Okay,
I'm gonna start with Bela Fleck as a guitar player. What should you take away from Bela Fleck's playing?
Creativity, no boundaries, no limitations. If you look at that from a genre standpoint, it's obvious. That's the surface level. But when I say no limitations and no boundaries, you know, he came out playing a bunch of single string, almost fiddle tune kind of lines and all the single string stuff, unison things. Banjo players didn't play like that. So before Bela, people were like, that's not how you play the banjo. And now you have Noam and all these freak show banjo players everywhere that do that thing that Bela – there's like the Bela Fleck is the Eddie Van Halen of the banjo.
Yeah.
Just because it was like everybody played electric guitar one way. And then after that kid in 1978 with a parts guitar did Eruption, everybody played guitar a different way after that.
Right.
You know? And so Bela is that. So I'd say definitely the no limitations, no boundaries. Even to this day, is, you know, it's like, he is still a deity to me. It's like Jimmy Page, Bela Fleck. Like, they're the same kind of level of, you know, Arthurian legend. And to this day, when he releases a record and it says Bela Fleck on the cover, I have no idea what I'm going to hear.
Yeah.
Like, there's no telling what it's going to be.
What's one Bela Fleck lick you've transcribed?
I mean...
Or is it mostly the technique and the roles?
It's all the things, right? So, like, one of the things that I really like is the way that those single note triplets, like, if you're just going to arpeggiate something, let's just take something simple. E minor 7, right? Guitar players struggle with one note per string stuff, so it's like cross-picking guitar players would play E minor. That kind of... And they would stick to those open strings and those kind of things, right? But like, you have the Bela thing kind of have more roll up. Those kind of things were like definitely things that I lifted from Bela. And I mean, gosh, so much of what he does is in the lane of a fiddle player and a mandolin player with a single note, you know, lines. It's very much that kind of thing.
Okay, what are the things you should take away from Steve Morse?
Definitely, God, there's so many. I think that it would be the articulation would be one. And by that, I mean, it's not just in the high speed stuff. Like when he riffs, it's the greatest thing ever. Like, just his riffing sounds amazing. When he was at Woodshed, he would just start riffing around. He's like, you know, when you're kind of playing an A and you got a rock lick, and he would just start, you know. Like, the articulation in his tone on his throwaway riffs sounded like they could have been
on. Perfect.
It was just sassy.
Yeah.
I think if anybody needs a master class in Steve, and obviously it's high tension wires, but I think the Dregs Bring Them Back Alive record, that live record is just spectacular. It's all the sass. And I think the thing that, you know, I always take away from Steve is the moment he bends a note, I can tell it's Steve Morse. He's just got this,
yeah,
this bend that just sounds like Steve. And the same way with Dan. Like Dan, nobody bends like Dan. He's the best, man. Yeah. It's the best.
Why is it still worth studying Van Halen? Like, what are the real takeaways that make it worth learning those solos and spending all the time on those licks versus anyone else?
Because Van Halen sounded like he was having more fun playing the guitar than anybody else on earth. And that's not a musical answer, but that is the real answer. That's the reason he transcended to people that don't play guitar. When he was on stage playing, he made it look like the kid in the sandbox when you're all a little kid at the daycare. He was the kid that had the thing that you wanted to go play with, the toy truck or whatever. And Van Halen on stage, just, he had the joy. It was just this pure, it just radiated. And the studying of his solos are, I think, just something that he was, you know, he left behind for us was all that music. The studying of the solos, man, it's like just a little glimpse at what it was like to be so happy playing the guitar. I mean, like, even in really dark tunes, like some of the Sammy Hagar tunes are really dark sounding. Those solos would come in and just, man, he's just, whatever Hendrix had, Ed had it. And I don't know what that is, but that's the thing. It's this intangible thing that transcends technicality and facility. It's just musicality. He just had a touch and a delivery, I think it's it. It just sounded like he just sounds like he's having more fun than everybody else that plays.
Yeah, that's a good answer. Can you give us a working man's lick that should be in everyone's arsenal? That's maybe like one shred lick and one chicken picking lick.
Okay,
that should be like you don't even go to the gig unless you have this standard lick in your bag.
Yeah, so like the shred thing is like, to me, it's less about a specific lick. It's more about understanding groupings and how to navigate groupings, right? So like the Gilbertism.
Yeah. What's the Gilbertism?
So a Gilbertism would be like something that cycles back and forth. I always think about that with maybe just blues. But he would like those kind of things.
How slowly can you do that? Can you do that pattern like super slowly?
Sure. I mean, all it is it's just taking three notes. Which one are we going to do? The blues, the blues one? I would just understand that the first thing I got to be able to do is and make that sound musical. You can feel that downbeat in the pulse, right? Speed it up. To me, when I go, this ties back into learning versus practicing, you have to make that sound musical before you can make a bunch of other notes sound musical. Because if that sounds square,
you're done.
You're already trying to race with a flat tire.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, to me, it's like getting your pocket right. And that doesn't sound that fast, right? Let's go clean. Right, but that's not far away from this tempo. It's there, right?
Yeah.
So, like, to me, that understanding those kind of groupings, and those are very even, where like everything falls on a down. Like when you're playing six note groupings, right? Like very Petrucci kind of thing. Like those kind of isms.
Yeah.
That definitely feels like putting things on the down.
How do you find the groupings though? Sometimes I feel like I have a hard time finding those groupings.
It's just slowing it down, right? Like it's slowing it down to the learning side, not the practicing side. So like you got to give yourself a chord, right? Give yourself a chord. Do you know your major scale? Now, are you sitting there playing your major scale in a block, stopping, unplugging, putting it in another block? Well, there's your problem, because you've left out gaps of information. It's understanding that this G note isn't always the first finger as much as we want it to be.
Right.
And it's understanding that we can, It could be on the first finger. Be on the pinky. It could be on any finger. It's just G. And if you've got to get from here and you understand this playing field and you understand, let's say this one, but this stuff right here is alien to you, then you don't need to be worried about groupings because
first figure that out.
You got to figure that out because that's your roadmap, right? So for me to get to groupings, it actually ironically spend more time working on things that aren't the groupings because the groupings will find themselves out. But let's one, two, three, four, five, six.
Right.
When you say I can't find the groupings, it's like, can you count to six? And if you can, there's your grouping, right? So go one, two, three, four, five, six. Now just pick another note and go one, two, three, four, five, six. So and it works the other way too.
And now rip that. Yes.
It's just getting the idea that you know where the fretboard is, you know. It's like you got to understand that the fretboard goes this way.
Right.
That's where the hard part is to me, is just realizing that the guitar isn't play this in this position, unplug, play it in another position, unplug. That's how you have these walls in your playing, where you only have comfortable spots. So to me, that's where that is. The next level of that, and we're not going to spend too much time on it.
Yeah, it'll be like we're running out of time, but
odd note groupings.
Yeah.
So take an odd note grouping, take that same thing. Do it in fives. One, two, three, four, five. But play it in consecutive fives.
Right.
Yeah, so just count the number that you want of the groupings, and then there it is. It's really up to you to plug it in and get it sound like you want it to.
Okay,
yeah.
We're running out of time. You gave us a masterclass right there in shred. Now give us a little chicken pick in.
Okay.
What's the strategy?
The strategy is understanding that the flat 7 is as important as the root. Anytime you have a flat 7, what key? A?
A is chicken. Yeah, right key.
That's as important as anything you'll ever do, right? Because that just understanding where all those 7-to-1 relationships are. Look at all the G's that happen within that. That's the chicken picking thing. And if you need the delivery of it, it's take all your pet licks that you're used to playing, like, you know, it's the phrasing, right? And with any style of music, you're only going to be as good as the how much you listen to it. So if you want to be a great chicken picker, you've got to listen to Roy Nichols and Albert Lee. Like, you have to know who Ray Flack is. You have to know who John Jorgensen, Will Ray are. It's like, it's not like, oh, I saw John 5 chicken pick, now I want to do it. It's like, understand the lineage of it. That's the most important thing, because you can't play what you can't hear.
When I talk to Guthrie Trapp about what he visualizes when he chicken picks, he says he visualizes like an A chord and a G chord in every position of the
oh,
neck.
That's it right there,
and
right?
That's all it is. Is that what you think of? He swears that that's the only thing he sees when he's chicken picking is basically that.
That's
and then
a lot of it.
And then the notes fill, you know, you fill in the six because you're missing the six.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what you think of when you're playing that style?
A lot of it is that. A lot of it is that. But I also want to connect every section. I like a lot of outside
stuff
too. Yeah. So I might go to get a neat sound. But yeah, in general, I'm just kind of thinking of if somebody says, hey, we're going to play a chicken picking song and it's in the key of A and I don't know anything else, that's all I've been given, I know that I'm going to have 1, 2, flat 3, 3, 4, flat 5, 5, flat 6, flat 7, root. And I mean, really, it's every note becomes available, because even a flat 9, that doesn't sound like it would fit. If you phrase it right, it will. Sorry, one more time. So yeah, it's really about just that root to flat 7 thing, and then just knowing that every note can be available to you.
All right, that makes a lot of sense. Andy Wood, who I've just tricked into giving me a guitar lesson for the past, start a podcast and you can get free guitar lessons, is the moral of the story. Really quickly, you just had Woodshed recently, yep. But it's going to be happening next year, right?
Right.
So make sure you be on the lookout.
Yeah, that's
to register early.
Yeah, for those who don't know what that is, that's our annual event. It's a 4-day weekend right here close to Nashville, about 58 miles away, 60 miles away. And we always have about 6 of the best guitar players on the planet. Over the years, we've had Bonamassa, Eric Johnson, Steve Morris, Brent Mason, Guthrie Trapp, Robin Ford, like you name it. Like, and it's limited to very VIP kind of experience, limited to 100 people. So yeah, and we're already halfway sold out. So if anybody's wanting to come next year,
register now. Charisma, the new solo album,
yeah,
which is burning.
Yeah,
everyone's loving this album, dude. It's sick.
People
are talking about it.
I'm stoked, man. We're all really proud of it. There's an amazing team involved in it. And, I had that time at home during COVID to start writing and not be distracted with anything else. And, you know, those are the 11 songs chosen from 52. So I think, you know, just having that luxury of volume lets you choose the best tunes. But yeah, everybody's really stoked about the record. I am too.
And this whole thing started because I made a post about the Deadpool movie. That's reviewing it.
We're both comic book nerds.
We're both comic book nerds. And I didn't love the movie, but you loved the movie.
I loved it.
Really quickly, defend the movie.
The movie, to me, the multiverse saga through Marvel has been kind of a mess.
Yeah.
And the reason it has been a mess is because there's been so much throwaway type material where there's not a lot of consequences, things like this. This movie really gave us consequences, and I love the fact that there's a universe that's nothing but a junkyard where all of those ideas are thrown in the trash. So now, every Fantastic Four film, every X-Men film, all of this stuff now sits with it was like it was canonized, if that's a word, everything. And I think that was a big move and a big keystone thing that will make any future multiverse movies have more weight.
There you have it. Tear us up in the comments there.
Yeah.
Andy Wood, dude, thanks so much for coming by.
Thanks, Zach.
Have we left anything out? Has anything been unsaid?
No. I think just go to andywoodmusic.com and look for me on, obviously, I'm on the internet, and I'm out there touring and playing. So, you know, come see us.
About to be out with Gary this weekend, Gary LaVox.
Yeah, we're going to go to Mississippi this weekend. We're wrapping up. I think we got about 5 or 6 more shows this year. But, you know, and then it's shifting gears and getting into Shiprock. So that's in January. So
when you started playing with Gary, you've been doing it for a couple of years now, right?
Yeah, he was the first guy back in the fray after COVID. And he was wanting to do the solo record and stuff.
When you started playing with him and you get the gig, what did they send you to learn? Like, did they just send you the Rascal Flatts recordings and you pick out what parts to play?
I think that's a better question for Nick, because Nick didn't work in that ecosystem. Whereas, like,
he plays Utility.
I played 16 months with Flatts.
Yeah, so you kind of.
So I already kind of. Yeah, it was like when I saw Gary, I was just seeing my bro again. Yeah. And I already knew, it's like, you're going to play with Gary. You're playing Fast Cars and Freedom and Broken Road and Life's a Highway, What Hurts the Most. I mean, it's like, you know that that's happening.
Yeah, right.
So it was very much more of, you know, Jim, the band leader, who also played drums on Charisma. Jim just called and be like, hey, man, Gary wants to get back to it. I was like, I'm in. So that's really how
it was.
You
guys sound awesome. It's a great game.
I'm telling you, man. And Gary loves the hot dogging.
Yeah.
He's got Mike Hicks on keys and Adrian and Nick and Jim, and everybody can play really well. And he loves the showing off. So it's like,
no, it's burning.
Yeah, he just, the more burning, the better.
Yeah.
He loves that. And I think that's really infectious to the band on stage and to the audience. We're improvising a lot. Like, Jim Rowley's got a microphone that only we can hear in our ears. He's like, end of three. and a four. You know, he's just calling things. Stuff, he's like, yeah. Flat seven, flat six, flat seven. And like, we're doing it. And I think it works in that environment because you have, you know, a bunch of guys that really are nerds for good picking, you know? Yeah. So it's a fun gig. And truthfully, my solo stuff has gotten so busy now. I just got back from Europe. I've really had to just make the hard decision of how much or how little I'm going to tour as a sideman from here on out, at least in the near future. So outside of Gary, I'm kind of not doing it, man.
Don't try to book him for your gig.
I mean, like...
Well, maybe try.
How many commas and zeros do you have involved? Maybe I could be persuaded.
Very fair. Andy, dude, thanks so much for coming on, being so generous with your playing, your knowledge. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, brother.
And we'll see you next time.
Yeah, man.